There are some materials available. I do have a sermon outline that's available, a few copies of that. It's just a place to be able to take notes, a place to put down thoughts or applications. I encourage you to be able to do that. Perhaps the note sheet will help you in that regard. You may already have a nice note-taking system of your own within your Bible. There's also a couple of activity sheets for the little ones among us. So you might want to take advantage of that. As we think about the word of today, Nehemiah chapter 2, you might remember that I'm in the midst of a bit of a building project. We've been converting a chicken coop into an outdoor studio. Yes. The little chickies are getting close to fly the roost, but before they do so, they want to have a little place of their own in the backyard to do studies, homework, whatever they want to do. It's been a little warm to do that, but it's just about ready. Well, I get close to do the roof. It took me portions of 3 days. I never have a large enough window of time to actually start a project and finish it. There's always something happens and I end up over here for some reason. Well, I'm getting to the final 2-3 courses of shingles, and I'm realizing I'm going to be 3 short. Actually, 5 tabs. You know, there's 3 tabs on a shingle, and I'm 5 tabs short, at least by my accounting. And sure enough, I get to that course, and yep, about that far away from the top. And what do? You know, the price of shingles these days, the price of everything these days, building materials, is quite substantial. Not really the best time to be converting a chicken coop into a studio. Well, I guess I could go look. I could go look back at the store that I bought these 3 bundles. It's just barely over 100 square feet. But I remember I bought the last 3 they had of this particular color. Well, I could still go and try. But then I thought, wait a minute. I have a friend. But then a little bit of fear and trepidation set in, because that friend has done so much for me already, even without petition, even without asking. I don't know. But then I cried out, Lord, what do I do? And I made a little text message. Are you there? Yep. Short answers, good, he's there, but you know, you'd like a little more emotion perhaps with it, just to affirm. I got a roofing question. Okay. Will you still be there? I'm on my way. Okay. Anyway, what a blessing the Lord provided. And in consultation with this resident expert, I realized I do need more than 3. I need about 7, because I need to finish it off backwards, you know, upside down once you get there. Some of you know what that means. And so provided. But perhaps you've had those kinds of needs, those kinds of situations where you need to go to someone and actually ask for help. It could be someone even more than a friend in terms of authority or prominence. It could be a boss. In Nehemiah's case, his boss is the king, the emperor of the entire known world. And he serves as cupbearer. And he has something to ask. So we're in the 2nd chapter of Nehemiah. We've been looking at Ezra and Nehemiah together, because in the old book, the old Hebrew version, Ezra and Nehemiah were one book. They were together. And interestingly, you know, sandwiched in between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7 is Esther. So that's the setting in which we are. And Ezra is the priest. And Ezra came and he was to rebuild the worshiping community. And now Nehemiah comes and he's to rebuild the society, to rebuild the walls of the community. And here's Nehemiah. He's gotten news from his brother, whether it's his real brother or whether it's a brother in his clan, don't know. But he gets word back from the officials in Jerusalem of the situation. The city is in disrepair. It's still in its destruction. No gates, the walls are broken down, wide open for enemies, wide open really just for disgrace. And this burdens Nehemiah, and he cries out to the Lord. And chapter 2 begins in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now, reading Nisan reminds me of a car, and that reminds me that I must admit a correction. I was wrong, and number one came to me afterward, after the sermon 2 weeks ago, and said, no, you were wrong on this little biblical issue. And I had said that Nehemiah was the shortest fella in the Old Testament, and I was wrong. Bildad the shoe height is the shortest. I just need to, you know, I'm glad we have the Bereans here, and we know our Bibles that well, that I can stand corrected. Well, Nisan is about April. And you'll remember back in chapter 1, verse 1, we were in the month of Kislev. I'm sure that all makes complete sense to us. Kislev to Nisan. Well, it's about 4 or 5 months, going from about December to April. So about 4 to 5 months have gone by, depending on the placement in the particular month. Here we have a man who has been burdened for the city of God. His body is in Susa, the citadel, the summer palace for the emperor, but his mind and his heart are in Jerusalem for the place of God's name, for God's people. So this opening section we'll simply call the heading, The Sadness of Heart. The mission, God's kind of mission, begins with a sadness of heart. So here we are in the month of Nisan, and Artaxerxes is king, and wine is before him. It must be a very festive time of some sort. And Nehemiah takes up the wine to serve the king. Now, cupbearers indeed did that formal service of taking the wine, taking a sip of it, waiting a little bit to make sure that he can actually stand and deliver it to the king. Unless someone would put a little drop of poison, the dragon with the flagon or the chalice from the palace or whatever might have some bad stuff in it, and the king could end up dead. So it's better that a servant end up dead rather than the king, right? You're questioning that. So good thing we don't have kings. So but with this, the cupbearer would gain a significant amount of rapport with the king. I mean, this definitely is one who will give his life for the king, for the good of the empire. And he becomes a close confidant. And you noted when we read that not only is the king there, but the queen is with the king as well. Now, it's not often that the queen is there. So the fact that the queen is there, it is particularly special and particularly close within the courtroom. And Nehemiah is there. He is a close confidant, close enough to be there when the queen is also there. And Nehemiah, the cupbearer, some old ancient documents tell us how cupbearers would have great influence as advisors and consultants within the court to the king. Nehemiah is a statesman. He's not simply a lowly little guy that crawls up and then drinks a little wine and gives it off. No, he's a statesman, a man of prominence, and he's accustomed to life in the palace. But this particular day, the king notices, verse 2, why is your face sad? Now the commentators go back and forth a little bit. You know, how did the king know that Nehemiah was sad? And did Nehemiah, you know, after all his prayers, did he just put on the sad face, trying to get attention? Well, you remember in those days, and maybe you've seen pictures, reliefs of the ancients in Persia, and they have beards, like, you know, big beards. So you could try to put on the sad face and try to make the corners of your mouth go sour. Takes a lot more muscles, they say, to do that than to go this way. But like with the beard, who's going to see that? Not overtly visible. Now, the sadness of heart more so comes through the eyes. Comes through the eyes. The king and Nehemiah, they know one another. They're close. They're personal with one another. And the king notices a sadness, a genuine sadness in the heart of his servant. And then Nehemiah is afraid. He's terrified because the king noticed. And, you know, it's wine time. You're not supposed to be sad in the presence of the king. It should always be happy and full of levity and joy and fun and humor within the courtroom of the king. And if you're one of his entourage, you do all within your best and all within your power to look good. Make him happy. For if the king ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. No, this is a sadness that comes through the eyes and is pouring out from the heart, a broken heart. Because the city of God, the dwelling place of God's name, is in ruin. A sadness of heart. Now, we say, well, why is the city so important? What's the big deal about this? It causes us to pause, just to remind ourselves. Well, even in Nehemiah, chapter 1, verse 9, it tells us that this is the place of God's name. I'll gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen to make my name dwell there. Nehemiah 1:9. God had chosen that city out of all the towns and villages of the world to be the dwelling place of his name, to be the temple residence. And so indeed, it's really more about worship and the glorifying of God than anything else. In fact, there's a powerful set of verses in a psalm that says, indeed, God is revealed in the ramparts. He's revealed in the citadels. Like, you know, we think of, okay, nature is a revelation of God, and Jesus is a perfect, absolute revelation of God, and the Word is a perfect revelation of Christ and of God. And we know that these things are true and accurate, but even within the realm of nature, you can get even more specific and say God reveals himself in the fortress. His characteristics, his nature, his essence is part of it revealed in the fortress. This is why Nehemiah is sad of heart. But we also know why it's important that Jerusalem be maintained, don't we? From the New Testament. Because Jesus has to die there. The Christ has to come to Jerusalem and ride in triumphantly and then be killed. This is why Jerusalem is ultimately important, because it's in the redemptive plan and work of God. And God is preserving this little people group to get to the Christ. And he's preserving this land and he's preserving this little city to get to the Christ and the place where our ultimate redemption is paid. This is why it's important that Jerusalem be kept and maintained and come back to life, as it were, after the exile. Now, we also know that this isn't the ultimate end of things either, because Jesus did say, he said, destroy this temple in 3 days and I'll raise it up. He's the real temple, of which this earthly one is simply pointing, directing. And we know that our hope and our joy and our longing is to be with God in his dwelling place. Indeed, that's one of the names of Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us. Hebrews 13:14 says, here we come and we have a lasting city. We seek a city that is to come. Granville is nice. Grand Rapids is nice. West Michigan is nice. Someone told me that Ludington is number 23 of one of the most charming cities in the nation. Counting Hawaii, counting Alaska, number 23. Wow. We live here. But we are looking to a city that is far beyond anything we can imagine. It's a celestial city. It's a city whose author and whose builder is God himself. In Revelation 21, we see the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven like a bride adorned for the bridegroom. But even between now and then, we worship. And Jesus says to the woman at the well, they're in this theological debate, and the woman says, our forefathers told us to worship on this mountain, and your forefathers told you to worship on that mountain. And Jesus says to her, forget about the mountains. The day is coming, in fact, it's now here, when those who will worship me in spirit and in truth. And it's Jesus is here. And so we're not worried or concerned about an earthly city. We're looking forward to the heavenly city. And meanwhile, we worship indwelt by Christ himself. He is with us. Well, this is why the city is all so important and why we spend this time dealing with this ancient book and this ancient story, the stories of which other tales are made of. You could read this and think of any number of Hollywood epic pictures. They borrowed it from God. So here is this burden. And it's a God-given burden. If we move ahead in the chapter to chapter 2, in verse 12, God put it in my heart to do this for Jerusalem. The burden, the sadness, the sorrow is the effect of God working within the heart of a servant to accomplish and do something of mission and purpose, of ministry. Nehemiah is not a priest. He's not a preacher. He's not a missionary. He's a politician. He's a statesman. He's like you and I. And he's out there doing his job, doing it to the best of his ability, but he got caught with a burden. And now his boss questions him. Sometimes we think that because if we're in God's will, everything will be jovial and happy. No, often when we're in the place of God's favor, he's placed upon us a deep burden, a sorrow and a sadness for the condition of his kingdom, for the condition of the church, if we bring it into today's terms. The condition of God's people, and our heart breaks. Well, with this, here is Nehemiah, and he's sad. I don't know what your face looks like when you go to work. His is sad. His is one that leads to the jeopardy. And the king questions him, and Nehemiah says, I was afraid. I've never been sad in his presence before. And now I'm afraid. Well, because the king's wrath, you don't want to encounter. So before he talks to the king, he shoots an arrow. He shoots an arrow to the real king, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Yes, I took the tip off, so it was safer. They're just target arrows. One in the commentator, J.I. Packer, he calls this an arrow prayer. Within a second, within a nanosecond of his thinking, he's on the spot and he's asked a question. But he doesn't respond immediately, does he? He first goes to the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the one who moves the king's hearts. And so he fires an arrow prayer up to the Lord, petitioning, God, help me. God, be merciful to me. Give me an answer for the hope that is within me. The thing that I've been praying for 4 months, now I have to speak about it. Now here's an opportunity. Is this the time? Is this the place? Now, the effectiveness of the arrow prayer, of the arrow shot, is only in part to the 4 months of preparation. I read some of those historical novels once in a while, usually when I'm traveling, and I've learned a little bit about archery through that. Not that I could do it, but you think of the old English longbow and the significant pounds of energy it takes to pull that back and launch an arrow. They began training their archers as boys, little boys, so that by the time they were mid-teens, they were able to actually pull a bowstring. They were hefty, muscular, bulky archers. The effectiveness of the arrow shot is due to all of that preparation, all of that shooting. Now, God hears our prayers, and we're grateful and we're thankful that he hears our cries. But when it comes to our relationship with God, have you been taking the 4 months of petitioning, the long, hard drawing of the bow again and again and again, so that when the moment comes, in the spur of the moment, in the pressure situation, what comes out of your mouth? I must admit that in hammering shingles, I went and I got shorter nails than normal so that it wouldn't poke through the little half-inch OSB sheathing. But in order to do so, you know, you can barely get your fingers to hold the nails. And there were times when little arrow prayers did not come out of my mouth, but blunt curses. Now, I didn't use the name of the Lord in vain. I am human, but I'm working on sanctification, and I didn't blow it that way. But when you're in a pressure situation, what blurts out of your thoughts? What blurts out of your mouth? Is it a petition of praise or supplication unto God? God, help me. God, help me. Well, Nehemiah is this, and someone said that Nehemiah is a leader from the knees up. Indeed, we see this. Well, as we think about this, think of how Nehemiah could have easily been distracted. He was in such a lavish place of life and service. Why worry about a broken down city? He was serving a king who demands happiness, in his presence. We also live, abide in a world that is distracted with all the opulence of a society and culture and affluence and material things around it. We could be so easily distracted by the opulence of this world and not have a vision for the city of God, and to gaze upon it and it would break our heart. Or we could be so distracted with the necessity of happiness that we forget about holiness. And our society attempts to cover its sorrows with a pasted smile upon its face. Well, that's a sermon all in itself, and that's just the first 8 verses. Verses 9 to 6 go on, and indeed Nehemiah is given permission to go. Well, he knows the plans that he needs. He's in his praying. God not only gave him the burden of his heart, but gave him the thought of what needed to be. Indeed, he knows the paperwork that he needs. He knows the provisions that he needs. He knows the pace at which he has to do it, and he knows he needs protection. All these things he knows, and on the spot is able to itemize to the king. Can I have these things? And the king says, yes. How long will you be gone? He sets a date, and he returns. Like, is this the end of the world? Do we need to cut, like, the red cord? Oh, it's me. My timer's up. In conclusion, it was supposed to be on silent. Okay. Well, quickly, he surveys the ruins, verses 9 to 16. Notice he rests for 3 days upon his arrival. He makes his appearance to the local officials that are there, and we'll meet them again later in even this narrative. Three dudes that have been in control all this time, but now here comes Nehemiah, who has now been made governor of the area. You talk about, you know, what does a staff do when the new senior pastor comes? What does a staff do when a new governor comes? We've kind of seen what happens when a governor fails out east a little bit, and all the mess with that. These guys are threatened by Nehemiah's presence. Well, Nehemiah does his, you know, makes his appearance known, makes his presence known to them, and then he goes to his capital city, Jerusalem, and he rests for 3 days. There's a pace. It could be that the Sabbath day was in there somewhere. Seemed to be like it was in Ezra's story. But he rests. This is a bit of practical advice for those of us with fatigue syndrome and the adrenaline rush. We need to rest. We need to pause. We need a pace. Our world increasingly is 24/7, and it propels us to be the same. But that's when we make mistakes. It's when we get discouraged. So he rests, and then he goes and makes his appraisal. He does his reconnaissance, and again, you get the epic picture of this. And he goes alone. He goes alone to survey. Now, some of you Civil War historians, you're thinking, oh, that's not a good thing to do. It's not a good thing to go out there in the dark alone without letting the guards know you're there, like Stonewall Jackson did, and one of his own guards shot him because he was sneaking around out there. There's Nehemiah sneaking around the walls like some hyena. But he's mounted. Not many would have a mount. This is a prominent man. He doesn't even get all the way around the walls. He gets maybe halfway or so, but it's enough. It's enough. He can see, did I get the right materials? Did I get enough of materials? Wood, stone. How are we going to go about this? He appraises the situation. But imagine the emotion for him. He's never been here before. He's heard about it in his Bible reading growing up as a boy. He's heard the stories from great-grandpa about the majesty of the old city and the old Jerusalem, but he's never been there, never been to the holy city himself. And now he's here, and he sees it in disrepair. And maybe the words of Psalm 48 come to his mind. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of all the earth. Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king. Within her citadels, God has made himself known as a fortress. Walk around Zion. Go around her. Number the towers. Consider well her ramparts. Go through her citadels that you might tell the next generation that this is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us forever. The beauty of a psalm written when the temple and the city were in their glory. He's heard stories of it, and now he walks around and he sees it in darkness and in despair, in ruin. There are times when I'll come here when it's dark. I don't turn on the lights. I refuse to be scared in our own place. And I'll walk around. I'll walk even up and down where you're sitting, catch my knee a few times, but walk back and forth. I'll go up into the cry room where they're having fun now. I'll go downstairs, go in those back little rooms, who knows what's in there. Come upstairs, walk around into the classrooms up here. And your faces all come to my mind as I walk, as I make the tour. Now, I'll just be frank. You know, here's Nehemiah waiting his whole life and yet praying diligently, you know, for those 4 to 5 months, and then he gets the opportunity to see revival come. I've been walking for 20 years, waiting for that revival to come. When you walk around, what are you seeing? What are you surveying? What are you appraising in God's church and in God's people? Do you take the time to do it? Do you take the time to walk around the walls of your own heart and appraise and assess? Where is it tore down? Where's a vulnerable spot? Where's the gate burned? What do I need to shore up, build up in faith and hope and love? Take the time. Take the 3 days and do an appraisal. Well, he does so, and there's a summons to work. He hasn't told anyone of this yet. He's been very discreet. In verses 17 and 18, he finally tells him, we need a revival. We need to rebuild. We need to renew the walls. and the temple. God told me so. I mean, I'm paraphrased, but that's, he shares with them his calling to this task. And it isn't that this is such a really wonderful speech. Really, when you look at it, you know, just by words, it's very, very, very short, simple, but to the point. See the trouble we're in? How Jerusalem is in ruins, its gates burned? Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. Like, that's the vision cast. That's it. And then he tells him how God has been good to him and provided for him to be able to get here, verse 18. And he says, they say, the end of verse 18, let us rise up and build. Wow. What a message. What a response. Let us build to a good work. Now, there's a lot of work that's out there. There's a lot of work that's in here. But concentrate on the good work. The good work. The good fight. The good race. Well, there is this revival among the people, but notice also there's resistance. Verse 19. Not everyone is going to share this vision. The chapter began with Nehemiah's sadness and sorrow, and it ends with laughter and mockery. The enemy is now laughing at Nehemiah and the people. You see the contrast? Heaven works godly sorrow that leads to repentance. The world brings unbelieving laughter that leads to hell. Now, we can be both holy and happy. Please don't misunderstand. It is in this book that we will find the joy of the Lord is our strength. Yes. But right now, when we see the walls broken down in a society, in a culture, and in a North American church, we need to take these 3 days and ponder and consider the reality of the condition. And we're going to be hearing the laughter and the mockery louder and louder. The din will increase. And some of us here will probably leave because we won't be able to stand the mockery. And so we come to passages like this to put our hand to the good work, to set our hand and to stable our feet, to remain steadfast in faith, in hope, in love. Now, God will one day come and he'll wipe away all the tears of those who mourn. And he will indeed quieten the laughing scorn with gnashing teeth. But there is here, the chapter doesn't end there. It ends with a confession of faith. It ends with confidence, a resilience in God. The God of heaven will make us prosper. And we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. God will do it. God placed it in Nehemiah's heart. God will do the work. One commentator said, are you in the world to do something, or are you in the world for something to do? Are you here at Grace Bible to do something, or are you just here for something to do? We need to pull together. We need to rally around building the city of God. Not in a geographical sense, not in a material sense, but in the bolstering of one another, standing side by side, contending for the gospel, and not afraid of anyone or anything. This is our call. This is our charge. To be resolute, resilient, repentant for the kingdom of God.